Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is Nicholas Fox Weber, writer and director of the Albers Foundation. And we're talking about his latest book, Annie and Yosef Albers, Equal and Unequal. Nick, welcome to the show. It is such a pleasure to be talking to you about this book. This book is this is the book of a lifetime. Okay, this is the kind of accomplishment that is just amazing. It's large for a reason. It's got beautiful reproductions positioned, and the way they flow is just excellent, and the writing is great. I had no idea you had this under your wing.
Well, thank you so much, Mark. The book really grew organically. Fiden approached me with the idea of just a book about both of the Alberses, and then I had the wonderful experience of working with two superb editors and a wonderful co-worker from the Albers Foundation, and it became quite natural to put things in certain places. I also discovered that I could tell the people with whom I was working some slightly outrageous story about the Alberses, and instead of just waiting for me to pipe down, they would respond by saying, use it in the book.
Well, the result is, and it's very easy with a book like this to just get blown away by the visuals. And there were so many things that I had never seen from them. So that's fascinating to me, especially a lot of your very early work. But the text has done a really, and I mean this sincerely, I felt like I got to know them as people. And how they operated and stuff like that. And they're very unique. But the two things together just make for a dynamite book. And also, you didn't just simply run the illustrations chronologically. You have juxtapositions of new and old work that are really interesting to look at and to compare. You can just get lost in any one section of this book.
Well, again, I just love hearing the things that you're saying, Mark. One, you're one of the first readers, and naturally, I hope for a response of that sort. I'm almost 73 years old, and I'm aware that having known Annie and Joseph was an incredible treat.
Yeah.
I'm also aware that Annie was 73 when I met her, and at the time, having grown up in West Hartford, having been surrounded by a certain milieu, I wouldn't have thought that these very plain-living, plain-looking people in their non-glamorous house were, in fact, the happiest people of their age whom I knew.
And let's talk, we got to get into this, otherwise we're not going to get anywhere about the life of Annie and Yosef. The title of the book is from a Yosef Albers oil on Masonite called Equal and Unequal, which is a fascinating piece. But tell me what the title means to you.
Well, for many years, whenever I visited the Alberses, I was aware that one single painting hung in Annie's bedroom, and there was nothing in Joseph's. He had blank white walls, and she had this painting called Equal and Unequal, hanging on ugly picture wire from a hook on the picture molding, because you wouldn't want to put a hole in a wall, and you have to be prepared to move at a moment's notice. That seemed to be the message. And Annie told me that for years she would look at the painting, which has two substantial forms, painted in black on a white background. They resemble each other. They're geometric. They reach out toward each other, in effect. They're very textured. And as you look at them, you try to make connections between them. You try to relate one to the other. You try to understand when you're going inside a shape and when you're seeing it from the outside.
Yeah.
And it's full of mystery.
It is.
But it was only after many years, maybe 30, of knowing Annie and Joseph, that I was looking at that painting one day and I thought, my God, it's Annie and Joseph. And I have a memory of the first time I met them. They were in the entranceway of their house. They were two powerful presences. You didn't notice one more than the other. They were different from each other. He spoke in a rather abrupt way with a Westphalian accent. She had this lovely, gentle manner of speaking with her Berlin accent. But there they were, two creative geniuses. And when I look at the painting, I see two things going on at once. One is, it's as if there's a magnetic attraction between those forms. And the other is, it's as if you could take the void between the forms, and it's what happens if you put magnets against magnets, yep, and they repel one another. So there's a simultaneous attraction and then this natural feistiness of each wanting to be on his or her own.
Yeah, the great thing in the book is you compare them to Tracy and Hepburn, which I think now that once I read that, I understood everything.
Well, you know, I am a Hartford boy. And,
well, let's start with their early lives. They came from completely different backgrounds, too. It was like some kind of fate that they got together. But talk to me about Annie's background and then Joseph's background.
Well, Joseph was from a Westphalian Catholic family. His father was a plumber, electrician, general contractor, and he was from the city of Bottrop, which is really the other side of the tracks. And he told me that there, because of coal mining in that region, and I'm quoting him, "Even your spit is black."
Wow.
In Bottrop.
Wow.
Annie, born 11 years later than Joseph, was from a wealthy Berlin family. She was Jewish, as she would say, in the Hitler sense, because it meant that she knew that she would be identified as Jewish. Her name was Fleischmann, and yet she had been baptized and confirmed in a Protestant church, and both of her families her mother's and her father's had had mass family baptisms. Now, Joseph was Catholic, and I remember Annie and Joseph describing the moment to me in 1925 when he finally got a job as a teacher at the Bauhaus. Annie had gone to the Bauhaus in 1922. Joseph had been there since 1920. And so you have the meeting in 1922 when she got there, rather quickly falling in love.
Huh.
And it's in 1925, with his getting a job, that they decided that they could, quote, meet the parents, those are Annie's words, and tell them their plans. Now, there I was in my early 20s in the Albers' very plain kitchen, Mark, just sitting at a formica table. And Annie said to me, "You can imagine." She had a suit made so that Joseph would look right for his for her parents. She didn't quite approve of the Mao collar that he generally wore, and said she had noticed that he was always the last person served in restaurants. So she thought, I mean, this is very, very Annie. She had the most novelistic sense of detail. And so she had a suit made in a style where he'd be served more quickly. And they went to Berlin to see her parents. And Annie said, you know, he was 11 years older, Catholic to her Jewish, poor to her wealthy, and an abstract artist working in broken glass shards. And she said that after 15 minutes, her mother looked at Joseph and said, "Our Anka," how they called Annie, "our Anka is so difficult, and you are so wonderful to Joseph. You can come home to us anytime."
Oh, nice. There are so many subtle details captured in this book that really sort of sets you thinking about what they were thinking about. Joseph, in the beginning, he was completing training as an elementary school teacher. And he saw two paintings by Paul Cézanne. And he describes it as the start of everything. And you reproduce these two paintings in the book. And yes, they are by Cézanne, but you really try to imagine how they struck him and how they set him off down this very different road that he was on.
Well, you're a wonderful student, Mark. And full credit to you for being so aware of these points. I mean, Joseph was often quoted in his lifetime as saying that Cézanne was the start of everything for him. And that would have to do with the blocky quality, the mystery, the use of voids, and the wonderful interplay of colors. But it was only when working on this book that I realized I ought to know which Cézannes he was talking about. And he used to visit his family in a German region called Sauerland. And the capital of Sauerland was a city called Hagen, or still is. And in Hagen, there was a collection belonging to someone named Carl Wilhelm Osthaus. The collection was called the Folkwang, and it had Cézannes in it. Now, Cézanne had just died in 1906. This was 1908 when Joseph was there. And when you look at the paintings that he saw, you can understand how the boldness and reality of the two of them captivated him.
There's so many of these early works and drawings that are in this book that I found fascinating. As you write, he was thrilled with human dexterity and machine engineering. And there's a great drawing of electric repairmen from 1918. And then you compare it to Ascension from 1942. And you can really see the evolution of where he began and where it went. There's also a whole series of animal drawings and even some erotic images of naked couples. I had no idea.
Well, when I found those erotic images, I felt it was in the year after Joseph had died. I didn't even know that he had done figurative drawings. I was helping Annie by cleaning out a basement in New Haven where he stored artworks. And I found over 150 drawings that he had identified as his, many of them signed. And I was quite astonished. When I found the one of two nudes embracing, seen from behind, I felt like a kid who had discovered his grandfather's erotic correspondence and had never seen that side of Grant before.
They're amazing, and they're beautifully done. There's a very subtle self-portrait from 1919, just a few lines, and it's at an interesting angle, too. We got to talk about Annie. I'm going to get caught up because there's so much to talk about. Annie, you talk about her as having an implicit distrust of retrospection. Can you elaborate on that?
Yes. Annie was someone who always looked forward in life. So she could have fallen into the mold that she was brought up to be in, which was to run a household, bring up children, and instruct the servants. And instead, she discovered the Bauhaus, a brand new school, experimental, pioneering. And when she told her father that she wanted to go to a place that had a new style, Mr. Fleischmann, who was a furniture manufacturer, replied, "What do you mean, a new style? We've had the Renaissance. We've had the Baroque. There are no new styles." Now, to Annie, that was retrospection. That was looking backwards instead of going forward. And her whole life, she never regretted what she had left. She always embraced the new. And even when she and Joseph were pretty much forced to leave Germany in 1933, I mean, they left early enough so that it was still by choice, but even then, she embraced the idea of America, newness, a whole new world for her. And to her, retrospection and too much nostalgia was dangerous because it would keep you from creativity and from a real appreciation of the present.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch, my returning guest tonight. Always a pleasure to talk with Nicholas Fox Weber, writer and director of the Albers Foundation, and we're talking about his latest book, It Has to Be Seen to Believed. It's a wonderful book. Ani and Joseph Albers, Equal and Unequal. Now, Oscar Kokoschka was her first drawing tutor?
Well, her mother took her to meet Kokoschka. And in Dresden, which I think shows how intrepid Annie's mother was.
Yeah, yeah.
But Kokoschka looked at the portfolio of Annie's and suggested that she return home and become a housewife.
Whoa. Whoa. There's so many weird details about her life that you just sort of throw off. After Joseph died, you talked about how Maximilian Schell, the actor, courted her in her 80s.
Yes.
I wanted to know a lot more detail of that.
That is absolutely true. I have written a bit more about that in a book I wrote called The Bauhaus Group, in which there's a chapter about Annie. But Maximilian met the Alberses because he wanted to use two Joseph Albers paintings as a stage set for Hamlet and have them enlarged appropriately. Joseph did not go along with that idea, but he was delighted that Maximilian bought paintings, and they met toward the end of Joseph's lifetime. After Joseph died, Annie developed, and the word is hers as well as mine,
okay,
a true obsession with this handsome, swashbuckling, seductive, younger man.
Mm.
And I remember at one point when I was worried about some of the effects of their relationship on her, she looked at me and she said, "I need the obsession to live."
Huh.
You can't argue with that.
I understand that. I totally get that. Another wonderful detail about her. She loved the orchestra tuning up.
Yes.
Now, this is before they play and they're there practicing with their instruments. Why was that so fascinating to her?
Annie was interested in process and how things come together. You could hear the full symphony and you wouldn't really know the violin does this, the piano does that. But when you hear instruments tuning up, you have a sense of the individual components. She always approached the making of art with a fascination with the tools, the machinery, and the things that make it possible. When she was in her 70s, I took her to the printing company Fox Press near to Hartford, and Annie immediately studied the printing processes, the machinery, what she could do with them. It was similar to that feeling for the orchestra tuning up. You needed to know what led to what.
Let's move ahead to the Bauhaus. And again, I want to mention for the benefit of the audience, we are skipping over tons of material. The two of them at the Bauhaus were fascinating. This is where they met. Joseph was older than most of the students, but he never followed the expected route. He was sort of a rebel at the Bauhaus.
Joseph initially used material from a junkyard to make glass assemblages because he couldn't afford art supplies. And then he entered the glass workshop at the Bauhaus and was utterly intrigued with the way that light passes through glass, producing pure and vibrant colors. And so he declared that he would do nothing but work in glass. And to answer your question, the Bauhaus masters told him that if he didn't branch out in work and work in other media, he was out. He wouldn't be able to remain at the school. Joseph's way of handling that was to do nothing but work in glass and make it so good that he gave himself a solo exhibition in the glass workshop and invited the masters in to see what he had done by disobeying them. And the result was that they elevated him from the position of being a student to that of being a Bauhaus master. He and two others were the first students to change role in that way.
These glass pieces, which are, several of them are in the book, I had never seen before, and they're beautiful.
They're just amazing. They're vibrant.
Yeah. His color choices are incredible.
Well, and if you can imagine this, Mark, the year that Joseph died, one of my tasks the following summer was to clean the garage. And it was like cleaning anyone's garage, except that it was much neater than most of our garages. There was a beautiful wall constructed of orange crates, and various things were stored in them, you know, turpentine and paint and, you know, salt for salting the driveway in the winter, that sort of thing. But I was going through everything, and I pulled down an upholstered envelope, and something fell very hard on my chest.
Oh.
It was a glass construction. It didn't break, nor did I. I went upstairs to Annie and said, look at what I found in the garage. And she said, that's what Yuppie made the year I met him, and he would go to the dump in Weimar with a backpack and a pickaxe.
Oh, wow. Well, talking about Annie at the Bauhaus was interesting, too. She entered the weaving workshop, and immediately she sort of learned that she could use the loom very inventively. It fascinated her as a tool, as you write.
Yes.
Her first works in weaving are amazing, but she thought that the woman who was teaching weaving, I think it was Helene Borner, was better equipped to teach needlepoint.
Yes. Annie could be very deprecating about things.
I guess so.
Needlepoint was one of them. Needlepoint symbolized no imagination and not really being involved in the process. Annie also had a way of referring to women who did needlepoint as those little ones trying to find themselves. And more than once, we would hear her, we being my wife and I, would hear her refer to those little ones. But in the case of weaving, although many people have acted as if she took up weaving against her will, she went to the Kunstgewerbeschule, the School of Applied Handcraft, before the Bauhaus to learn textile technique. And once she was at the Bauhaus, she knew she couldn't enter another workshop. She was physically frail. She couldn't get on a ladder and do wall painting. She suffered from an illness called Marie-Charcot-Tooth syndrome. Yep. Never talked about it, never victimized by it, but accepted its limitations and affected her feet and hands. And weaving was the one option of something she could do. And she said that Paul Klee, the form master, had talked about taking a line for a walk. And Annie thought that was such a beautiful notion that she would take thread and do with it whatever she could.
That's one of my favorite quotes by Paul Klee, by the way. The Bauhaus ends up moving from Weimar to Dessau, and they get married for the rest of their life. And in the beginning, the very beginning, their work resembled each other's for a little bit. But they were very fiercely independent people, but they loved, and they were, and this is a term from your own, from the book, they were connoisseurs of the human comedy. They loved watching the other couples at the Bauhaus.
Well, it's perfectly true, and they would speak about them in the same way. And, you know, Annie and Joseph showed me a letter that they had received from the Kandinskys. As you know, Wassily Kandinsky was one of the great painters at the Bauhaus and a teacher there, and he had married a much younger, very flirtatious woman named Nina. And Annie and Joseph just did not take Nina Kandinsky very seriously. And they showed me this letter in which Kandinsky, following the closing of the Bauhaus, wrote from Paris and talked for 12 pages about how difficult it was to make his way in the gallery scene and anywhere else in Paris. And what was written at the end by Nina was simply a single paragraph. They have the most marvelous new hats at the milliner's, and I danced with the Duke of Rhodes.
the details of the lives of the other artists of the Bauhaus seen through their eyes is fascinating. I mean, Paul Klee in his customized kitchen making steamed lung ragu. And then Mies van der Rohe and his mistress, Lily Reich, and the infamous Butterballs story. Just their observations are amazing. I mean, that would make a book alone just of how they remembered these other artists.
Well, and Annie and Joseph had a particular way of seeing. So sometimes it was just really comic. And they had sides that surprised them. I mean, I don't think people writing very earnestly about Annie Albers picture her being obsessed with watching the Merv Griffin show on television. And she was.
And she was.
She was indeed. Her hero at one point was the television repairman because, quote, I can see Merv again.
Now, the Bauhaus is forced to move again.
Yes.
And what finally brought them to realize that they had to move out of Germany?
In April of 1933, the Gestapo padlocked the doors of the Bauhaus. Mies van der Rohe was the school director. Joseph was one of the remaining seven faculty members. The German government had cut off salaries and made it impossible for the school to remain in Dessau, which is why it moved to an old factory building in Berlin. And after the Gestapo padlocked the doors, they met with Mies, director of communications for the Third Reich, met with Mies and said the Bauhaus could continue so long as it worked in tandem with everything required by the new state, by the Reich. And Mies wrote a letter to Joseph, and I found this letter in his desk a couple of years after I started working at the Albers' house. And Mies wrote a letter saying, "These are the circumstances. I assume that you agree with me that we should close the school."
We're going to end it right there because we're out of time.
Okay.
So we're going to continue this conversation, aren't we, Nick?
Oh, you bet, Mark. I love talking with you.
Because
nobody more.
The big move to North Carolina comes up next, and we'll continue the story there. My returning guest tonight is Nicholas Fox Weber, writer and director of the Albers Foundation. And we've been talking about his latest book, which is just chock full of all sorts of interesting stories and information and beautifully illustrated, too. Annie and Joseph Albers, Equal and Unequal. Nick, it's been a pleasure.
Great pleasure for me, Mark. I thank you so much.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.